Welcome to Holden Village. Today's speaker is Paul Olson, and he will be doing a session entitled Job Today, Patience or Affirmation. So, let's listen in on Paul.
What are some of the questions before you we ever start together that you've had always kind of lingering about Job? About the book Job, the story, whatever, you know, what? Anybody have any questions?
Well, my biggest problem was I think I answered it, but I'm not sure if I answered it correctly. Why did God allow Satan to take over Job's life, or to cause problems in Job's life to such a degree when he knew that Job loved him so much?
Oh, my God, it's over here.
You know what they felt that these things were for?
I just shortened it from my own writing state. Why allow Satan so much power over Satan? Over Job?
And my question is, am I supposed to learn something from this now? If so, what? Because it's a puzzling story. I can't figure out how it applies to me.
It's interesting and ironic that the scholars call this, or the elders of the Hebrew tradition call it the wisdom literature. And man, it's the most confusing wisdom stuff I've ever. Okay, good. What else? Anybody else? I mean, they're kind of that's kind of the heart of Job. I mean, for all of us, you know, gee, what kind of a God is this that makes this? That's what I'm going to write down. What kind of a God? And then a quick story before we start. A story that probably you've all heard, but it's always a reminder to us of what the storyteller in this story means by faith. And for me, it's my favorite story about the nature of faith, and I think Job, the way we look at it, the way Archibald MacLeish, the poet, looks at it, it's kind of a statement about the nature of faith, too. And the story is of this man who's walking along the edge of a cliff in a very pristine part of the world, and off to his left there are mountains like there are here at Holden, and he can see these big black mountains sweeping up to the sky, and the sky is blue, and they're covered with snow on the top. And down to his right is this deep, deep valley, and it's also pristine, and it's green and beautiful, and there's a river running through it. And it's just a spectacular view on all sides, and he's just so caught up in this, looking around, that he falls off the cliff, 500 feet straight down to the bottom of that valley. Well, about 250 feet out, there's a branch sticking out, and he grabs that branch, and boom, obviously he's been doing his push-ups because he can stop himself. And there he is, swinging on that branch, he's holding up, you know, hanging on for his dear life, 250 feet down, 250 feet up, and he says, "Help, help, can anybody help me? Help, help, can anybody help me?" And those clouds start to rumble together, and a big voice echoes down, "Yes, I can help you. Who are you?" More rumbling in a bigger voice, "I am God. Are you sure you can help me?" "Yes, I can help you. What do I have to do?" "Let go." "Is there anybody else up there?" And it's about, even if you were here yesterday, that kind of existential emptying of everything. This guy cannot come to God until he lets go. Or another way to put it in the positive, all he has to do, and that's a better way to put it, is let go. And then you can come to God. But unless you do, you're going to be dangling there on that branch. The only secure thing in his life, and he's got to hold on to it. That relates to Job, and it relates to Archibald MacLeish's, I think, picture of Job as we'll look at him. So what we're going to do is start right now. You still okay, Janet, for the bus? Where'd you go?
Yeah.
Oh, you okay? Okay. We're going to look at the first chapter of Job, which is the prose part, and then there's prose again at the very end. And all in between is poetry. Well, we're going to condense all that poetry into three little speeches of the comforters as rendered by Archibald MacLeish, the playwright and poet in American literature, in his modern-day Job story called J.B. So first we'll have the story of Job is told by you guys.
Is that Land the Oz?
That sounds good to me.
Okay. There was a man in the land of Oz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she asses and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each on his day, and they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said,
"It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts."
Thus Job did continually. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan,
"Whence have you come?"
Satan answered the Lord,
"From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it."
And the Lord said to Satan,
"Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, who fears God and turns away from evil?"
Then Satan answered the Lord,
"Does Job fear God for naught? Hast thou not put a hedge around about him and his house, and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth thy hand now, and touch all that he has, and he will curse thee to thy face."
And the Lord said to Satan,
"Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself do not put forth your hand."
So Satan went forth in the presence of the Lord. Now, there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And there came a messenger to Job and said,
"The oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them. And the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you."
While he was yet speaking, there came another and said,
"The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you."
While he was yet speaking, there came another and said,
"The Chaldeans formed three companies and made a raid upon the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you."
While he was yet speaking, there came another and said,
"Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came upon the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you."
Then Job arose and rent his robe and shaved his head and fell upon the ground and worshipped. And he said,
"Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord."
In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong.
We'll keep going. The prose.
Oh, again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan,
"Whence have you come?"
Satan answered the Lord,
"From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it."
And the Lord said to Satan,
"Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you moved me against him to destroy him without cause."
Then Satan answered the Lord,
"Skin for skin, all that a man has he will give for his life. But put forth thy hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face."
And the Lord said to Satan,
"Behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life."
So Satan went forth in the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd with which he scraped himself and sat among the ashes. Then his wife said to him,
"Forgot to have a wife. Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die."
But he said to her,
"Thou speakest as one of the foolish women that speaketh. What, shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil?"
In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place. Eliphaz, the Temanite, Beldad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come to condole with him and comfort him.
Great. Great job. Give him a hand, you guys. That's an honor. Now those three comforters are the people that we've assigned. We've got the handouts from Archibald MacLeish's play. And we're in the audience now. And if we can imagine Job, who is rich, he's got one big farm with a lot of animals, and he's got a great family, and the family is now gone. He's dressed in rags. Imagine this man in rags, who's done nothing wrong. And that's where it starts. And the first person that comes to visit with him, you read the three comforters come, is Bildad. And Bildad, I think, in a modern-day play, might be dressed in I can think of the best symbol I can think of for a Marxist historian might be a Nehru collar. So he comes and talks about the power of history. And what we're having from these comforters now are explanations of why this happened. Explanations of the questions that we ask ourselves. So it's not just Job who asked the questions, it's also the readers or the audience too. Well, Satan, why do you have so much power? What's the message? What kind of a God is this? What other questions? And there are more. The suffering, I'm innocent. Why should I suffer? Isn't there a cause and effect relationship? Isn't God just? Isn't God merciful? Well, all those answers, and so far seem to be no. And I'll just point out to you before we get to these comforters that Job was so righteous that he offered a sacrifice after his kids had a party. Remember that? Just in case they might have sinned. They didn't, but in case they might have, three's too many beers. A beer's a sin, I guess. We're going to offer a sacrifice just in case. So, here are those comforters. And who's ever Bildad, you got that. They're all making fun of Job, and they're just rocking on him. And Job says, I am innocent.
Innocent. Innocent. Nations shall perish in their innocence. Classes shall perish in their innocence. Young men slaughtered in cities, offering their silly throats against tanks and innocence, shall perish. What's your innocence to theirs? God is history. If you offend him, will not history dispense with you? History has no time for innocence.
No, God is just. We are not squeezed naked through a ridiculous orifice like bulls into a blazing ring to blunder there by blindfold laws that we never learn or can, deceived by stratagems and fooled by feints for sport, for nothing, till we fall because we're pricked so badly.
Screw your justice. History is justice. Time, extraordinarily turned in truth. Not for one man, for humanity. One man's life won't measure on it. One man's suffering won't count, no matter what his suffering. But all will. At the end, there will be justice. Justice for all. Justice for everyone. On the way, it doesn't matter.
Guilt matters. Guilt must always matter. Unless guilt matters, the whole world is meaningless. And God, too, is nothing.
You may be guiltier than hell, as history counts guilt and not one smuggling thumbprint on your conscience, smudging thumbprint on your conscience. Guilt is a sociological accident. Wrong class, wrong century. You pay for your luck with your lips. That's all.
The historian has spoken, and I just highlighted some of those phrases. God is history. God is not this loving, intervening God. God is the forces, the inexplicable and inevitable forces of history. That's God. And not for one man. One man doesn't count. Listen to him. Along the way, it doesn't matter. We're just going to roll along the turning world and the turning time, and history will have its way. And whatever we are in the midst of this unfolding history is just simply a sociological accident. Listen to his phrase: wrong class, wrong century. You pay for your luck with your licks. Thank you.
If you would have been born black 3,000 years ago, you'd have been on top of the world. And you're born black today in America, you're at the bottom of the heap. Wrong class, wrong century. You pay for your luck with your lick. You know, you pay your licks for your luck. Okay. The next comforter comes, and that person is a psychologist, suggesting to us that, again, Job, you have no role in this. There's nothing you can play. And I'll point out to you do you know the story of Oedipus Rex? Oedipus the king? I'll tell it to you, just remind you real quickly, and interpret it a way that might fit what MacLeish is about here. Oedipus the king, is ancient Greek play by Sophocles, is a story where the king and queen have a baby, and they send the baby out with a servant to the oracle to find out the baby's future. And their future is predicted that this baby will grow up and kill its father and marry its mother. Well, they aren't real happy about that prediction. So they say, we're going to get rid of this kid, and they give him to Creon, the servant, and say, take the baby away, take him up in the mountains and kill him. Well, Creon can't kill him because he doesn't want to, and then he sees a stranger walking through the mountain path. He says, are you going far away? And the guy says, yep. He says, you want a baby? He says, yep, we'll take him. He takes the baby off to far, far away, many countries removed, and somebody else there adopts him. The baby grows up, and the parents send the baby out, or the baby himself, now Oedipus, goes out to the oracle to find out what his future is. And the oracle tells him, you are going to kill your father and marry your mother. And he says, oh my gosh, that's awful. I don't want to do that. I'm going to leave. So he leaves his home and goes back to where he was born. And on the way, to make a long story short, he struggles with a man in a fight over who gets to cross the bridge first, and he kills him. Guess who? Dad. Well, Dad was the king. Now the country is without a king, and the country is also in the midst of a plague. The plague is more complicated. And if you can solve this strange riddle, the plague will be over. Well, Oedipus can solve the riddle. The plague is over. He becomes king, and along with his kingship comes the queen, and he marries his mother. Every choice he made, deliberate, calculating, thoughtful choice that he made, choices that he made, led to exactly the wrong consequence. That isn't what he chose to do. Is he guilty? Well, the comforter here suggests that, no, you're not guilty. And that don't worry about it, JB. You're not guilty. And every time he hears the argument from the historian and now from the psychologist, one more slash has been taken away at his own faith and, more importantly, his own concept of what God is. So here we go with that. And JB starts out, first of all, complaining about these guys' comforters. As comforters, Eliphaz, be ready. JB just says, you guys haven't comforted me at all. We have forgotten pity.
No, we have surmounted guilt. It's quite different, isn't it? You see the difference. Science knows now that the sentient spirit floats like the chambered nautilus on a sea that drifts it under skies that drive. Beneath, the sea of the subconscious. Above, the winds that wind the world. Caught between that sky, that sea, self has no will. Cannot be guilty. The sea drifts, the sky drives, the tiny, shining bladder of the soul washes with wind and wave, or shudders shattered between them. There is no guilt, my man. We all are victims of our guilt, not guilty. We kill the king in ignorance. The voice reveals we blind ourselves. At our beginning, in the inmost room, each one of us, disgusting monster, changed by the chilling moon to child, violates his mother. Are we guilty? Our guilt is underneath the Sybil stone, not known.
I'd rather suffer. Every unspeakable suffering God sends, knowing it was I that suffered. I that earned the need to suffer. I that acted. I that chose. Then wash my hands with yours in that defiling innocence, one of the great lines of the play, and of all this whole concept of the Job story. Can we be men and make an irresponsible ignorance responsible for everything? I will not listen to you. And the last comforter is a guy, I think, in a clerical collar talking about original sin. And J.B. says, before Zophar speaks, till I die, I will not violate my integrity.
Your integrity, what integrity of you, a man, a miserable, mortal, sinful, venal man like any other? You squat there challenging the universe to tell you what your crime is called, thinking because your life was virtuous. It can't be called. It can. Your sin is simple. You were born a man.
What's my fault? What have I done?
What is your fault? Man's heart is evil. What have you done? Man's will is evil. Your fault, your sin, are heart and will. The worm at heart, the willful will, corrupted with its foul imagining.
So we have original sin. That's why, Job, you don't have to do anything. You aren't directly responsible. You're part of humankind. You're a sinner. Therefore, zap, this is what some of you get and some of you don't get it. You're just out of luck. We got the sociological, historical explanation, and I drew a diagram, a bad one, of the psychologist talking, just to kind of give make the image itself concrete. If this is the chambered nautilus drifting on a sea that drives, on the winds that blow, it has itself has no will. It just goes wherever the wind, you know, wherever the currents take it, wherever the wind blows it, it just goes. And it, like Oedipus, in ignorance, you know, we kill the king, he said. And then when we find out, we blind ourselves, he did that in the story. Well, here we have it. I mean, that's a quick synopsis of 39 chapters in between the prose and the beginning and the prose end of Job. What do we do with that?
You know, one of the things that none of them have really touched on is the fact that they're all saying that God is doing the things to Job, and he's not. It's Satan. God has allowed it. That Satan has done. So they're misunderstanding exactly what's going on anyway.
It's a great point. So one of the things that we know, the red is easier to see, you said, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, one, God allows, does not do. And the comforters seem to miss that. They have some other explanations too. That's
it's
a great point.
It's not very comforting though, because that either means God's omnipotence is not stopping Satan, or God's capricious in allowing, in choosing not to use God's power.
We're still back to the question, why would a loving God do that to a faithful servant?
Yeah.
Right.
Or to anybody.
Isn't that what happened to Jews?
Isn't that what happened to his son?
Isn't that what happened to his son? Well, that's good. Isn't that what happened to his son? Isn't that what happened to the Jews? And there's a wonderful character in the play, who's a kind of an ultimate cynic who watches this whole thing, who says in support of what about God's capriciousness and God's power, his line is, if God is God, he is not good. Or if God is good, then he is not God. Because evil has the control. And that must really be the God then. Well, we don't have much satisfying feeling, many satisfying feelings, do we? Or satisfying intellectual responses either. What are these, take any one of them, the Marxist, the historical theorist, the pastor, the original sin, and the psychologist. Take any one of them that you want to and just kind of respond to that explanation. They have their world views. This is how I look at the world. And the world is, and then they give an explanation, and this, and each one has their own. Any one of those in particular, you've given a good summary of all three of them together, any one of them in particular strike you as comforting? Or analytical?
No. Part of what happened to Job, he got caught in the middle of a war, too. People are attacking him. They're attacking his animals and the servants who are guarding them. So he's kind of caught between two factions that are warring, or maybe an army marching through to go to war. And those aren't those things that's happening in Sarajevo. They're caught with two in between warring factions, citizens being killed.
So it's just life.
It's just life.
And that's a bad spot to be in.
This is a particular story that brings out this. But if you really think of it, those things happen. They really do.
Boy, don't we know. Yeah. Well, that's good.
I'm sorry. I go back to what we were talking about before about the capriciousness and all that. And that if you look at God as a parent, as the Father, and us as parents, or we as parents, we would allow things for our children to go through as a learning experience, although we still love them. And maybe that's what he's doing here with Satan, allowing that to happen. And obviously, he's proven a point to Satan, too, because Job doesn't give up. I mean, he keeps his faith to a point.
Yep.
And at the same time, he's giving Job a chance to see what it's like not to be rich and powerful. And
so long as all of his children?
Yeah, it sounds like child abuse to me.
Well, I mean, obviously, we wouldn't let that happen to our children, but I mean, it's the same. If you look at the whole scoop, he let his own son die for these days. For a reason. A reason that we can't comprehend.
I think that to me sounds a little too simple somehow. Mm-hmm.
That's not the end of the story.
Great. It's a great answer, and what a response that it sounds simple, because we know you're not simple-minded, but all the answers we struggle for with with the book of Job are going to be simple. We're going to try to make it simple, and that's what these comforters do themselves. They come in and say, this is why, Job. I mean, I really don't know, but let me give you my theory. And the next guy comes along and says, we skipped that line in here, but after one of the comforters speaks, one of another character says, bullshit. You know, I've got my own theory, and then he gives his. And that's what it becomes, is that we've got this BS against this BS and against this BS, and they're each trying to oversimplify here.
Well, it distracts your relationship with God, all these comforters. And that's what I got from the book of Job, is that it just distracts your persistence and patience more than persistence.
Okay, so...
Because I believe God allows, he does not do.
One of the truths of this is that Job is quite patient. Are you saying that?
And then the comforters are trying to distract them by boxing up the whole scene and saying, this is what's going on.
Yeah.
Need little answers to distract.
I mean, they're very difficult answers because it takes God, it took our Bible group about all winter to even read it.
No, we're doing it in an hour. Like, we got that with those guys. One, two.
Slow. Yeah.
One of the things in Walter Wink's works, he talks about Satan's relationship to God within this period of Jewish history. And he points out that Satan was not seen up in the post to God as much as he was seen coming from God and being the one who questioned God, you know, to help God. He was the Pharisee of God's realm, so to speak,
and
keeping God within the law. And so when we look at it from our eyes, seeing Satan as evil, at the time that Job was understood, Satan was not seen as evil as we understand it today.
And... okay, good. Well, I've got a question for that, but go ahead first.
Job is probably written relatively late in Israel's literary history, and tried, to combat an official theology that said that God could be understood by theology, that if you just had enough of you had the right answers together, you could understand God, and that righteousness was certainly attainable. This theology said righteousness was attainable. And that God was mostly concerned with justice. If you do the right things, God will reward you. And Job was written as a counterpiece, almost as a parody on the official Jewish theology that said, you get all your ducks in a row and everything's going to work out great in life.
Yeah.
And that's not how Jesus said it either. That's not going to happen. And Job is, I think, a relatively late literary document in the Old Testament.
Good, thank you.
That's interesting what you just said. Our group, we had a group that was in Israel, and we had this guy that was incredible, and he said is their view today in general was that if we all get it together, we can bring the Messiah. If we do it right, we can bring the Messiah. Well, it's kind of the same thing. And
no matter what happens.
Yeah, well, if we get all our acts together, we can bring the Messiah, and that'll take care of it. It's up to us.
If everyone did the commandments for one day, just one day, the Messiah would come.
They didn't learn from Job.
And righteousness is not given. And it's not even really a quality to have to be distributed. Isn't that kind of good?
It sure didn't do Job any good.
No one is righteous, no, not one. Does that go back to the original sin perspective, though?
Well, so then are we going to jump on the clerical collar guy and say, well, you've got the answer. He's the one that's got the truth. We're going to dismiss the Marxist historian who says it's a sociological accident, you're just born in the wrong time, wrong place. We're going to dismiss the guy who says that you're not really guilty, it's just, you know, no, it's psychological determinism and you can't help it.
He learned that in seminary, not in experience.
Pardon me?
He learned that in seminary. That's the official line of original sin. He didn't learn that.
Oh, the clerical guy did. Yeah, yeah, okay. So, but are we going to buy that? That's the reason. You're born a man, and the world is sinful, and you know we're going to get zapped, and we just hope it. I hope it ain't me. That's all. You know, is that the line that we buy? And we're going to pick out of all these characters that come, and it's 39 chapters, I think, maybe 38 chapters worth of these guys coming at him and giving them explanations, minus about four that were God coming to him, and God doesn't really help much either in that situation. If you remember that part, you know, comes out there flashing his power and says, "Who? Who are you, you little turkey?" I mean, I can, and he lists all the things that he's done. But we're going to buy the one argument out of all of those that the clerical guy, is that satisfying to us?
No.
Okay, it isn't. So then we got to deal with that. When we're students of literature, we're trying to do good reading and let the reading work on us. And we say, okay, I guess that's why a literature teacher can and students of literature can explore this together without any kind of theological background. We can just look at this and say, well, what's satisfying about this? Literature's supposed to teach us, you know, affirmation of life. In a class a few days ago, I said, I tell my students, the one thing, if you get nothing else from the class that I teach, I hope you get that literature's about reverence for life. Well, where's that in this? Even at the end, Job's kids are restored, right? But he gets new ones, that's what it is. He's still got seven dead kids. Are we satisfied?
What's the reason for his faith? We haven't even begun to talk about Job himself.
That's a great question. What's the reason for his faith? And we better explore Job's faith in this. Till I die, I will not violate my integrity. And there's a lot of theological language experts interpret what integrity means in the Hebrew. Some people say it's just an integration with his whole self, and other people say it's honesty.
Something that bothers me about this was what part did the devil play in this? Was it totally, or was it God allowing the nature, the freak of nature that causes the house to fall on his children and kill them all? Is something, we've got volcanoes, we've got windstorms, we have earthquakes, and lots of people get killed by these things. Because we have moved, let's say, we've moved out of the Garden of Eden into the thistles. We live amongst a secular world. We have governments. Ours is, we're probably pretty fortunate where we live right now, the freedoms that we have. But that's not the way it is all over the world. And I just see, these happenings of nature being part of the science of how God put the universe together. The universe was created out of what we would call violence, explosions, and coagulations of hot gases. And here's this thin little layer of atmosphere around this one little tiny planet. And if we get outside of that, it's even our environment is even more violent. We thought volcanoes were bad. Get out there in space and lose your spacesuit. It just seems to me that we test our boundaries.
But in this story, he never gets tested till Job or till Satan suggests it. I mean, what's the question? I mean, that's a real important question to ask. What does Satan say to God?
You've put a hedge around it.
Of course he's going to worship you. Look what you've done.
Peter, help me out with the language in the New Testament. Peter asked that question. Hey, God, Jesus, what's in it for me?
We call what happened with Mount Pinatubo. We call that. Was that God or was that the devil? Or is it just creation, the formula of creation happening?
That's a great question, and I sure don't know the answer. And I think the situation is a little different in this book, in the story, I mean, as the there is a cause and effect relationship. You're right that some of these things you've already pointed out are social. There's a war going on, the Chaldeans come down. Another, you know, the winds come by, that's kind of natural causes. But none of these things happened before. They all happen at once, the messenger's there. I mean, in the story, there seems to be a cause and effect relationship, doesn't there? I mean, do you feel that? And so somehow God and Satan got this thing going, and
really, it says right in the Bible, if you believe biblically what it says, the Lord said to Satan, he's in your hands, but don't take his life. He could have free will to do anything else with that person. So, yeah, God allowed him.
The other way is to look at the story as, I don't want to demean it, but a fanciful, I can use that, explanation for why bad things happen. Well, let's say that there's this creature, Satan, and let's say he has this conversation with God. Well, bad things happen, and yeah, sometimes somebody's life is great, and then all of a sudden, in a period of 6 months, everything does fall apart. We all know people that's happened to. Some of the comfort I get from this story is by what's missing. I never thought about this story until now, but we don't hear from God again in the book, and I just imagine that God's heart is breaking as all this is happening to Job, in the same way I imagine God's heart breaks when he sees these things happening today to people. And for me, that's a comfort. I mean, that no, I don't believe God causes these horrible things to happen, but God knows they happen, and it's part of the world. It's part of the created universe. Well, then you get the question, well, if God created it all, maybe God. But I'm comforted by the fact that God is with us, and I think God's heart breaks as well when all this happens.
That's a great response to where, as an English teacher, I use the phrase, literature is life. And that is, what happens to the characters in the story happens to us. And what happened to you in that is that you brought your image and ideas about God, this loving God, to the story and said, I can live with that now. There's a corrective for that, though, by the story, and is that God isn't loving in this book. And when God finally speaks to Job, what does he say? I mean, we didn't read that part, but do you know that, anybody? Who is this that darkeneth counsel? Who is this puny guy waking me up, bothering me with this stuff? Where were you when the calf foaled? Where were you when the eagles were created? Can you sound the depths of the sea? You are nothing. He tells him over and over again, and it doesn't sound real loving. And J.B. or Job still says, I'm innocent. What I'm suggesting is we as readers bring to this an explanation the same way the comforters bring explanations and the same way Job, he can't bring an explanation, so instead he just brings what? This is what I know is true. I am innocent. I'm suffering. God, I always thought was just. Something's going wrong here. Well, what do you make of that? There's a lot of ironies there that we kind of have to sort out as readers.
It's certainly a piece with the lament songs where what the writer can shake his fist at God. Call God bad names.
Yeah,
you know,
and he does.
I wonder if our religious life allows us to call God bad names and say, you've done me dirty, and and here in this, certainly in ancient Israel, you wouldn't be allowed to do that. And yet Job and some of the Psalms are willing to take God on and yell and scream at God. When was the last time any of us ever got angry with God and, you know, gave him a finger or, you know, yelled and screamed or anything like that?
There's a certain, you know, I guess that opposes me, that honesty of Job's, that he is can speak to God in that way, and God answers him. I mean, maybe doesn't answer him in a what we think of as a sweet way, yeah. But God does not remain silent. God answers him.
Still a partner in a conversation.
Yeah, there's something going on there.
The strength of their relationship is phenomenal.
Let's perhaps, so we won't come away with answers, but we can get a sense of what the story does to us, is step back and see what are the truths of this story. And Gloria just gave one. I've shortened what you just said, I think. That the moral questions that Job asks are different than the theological questions. And I mean, that is, what have I done to deserve this? I've been a good guy. And so then, okay, and he's trying to figure that, but then he connects that to theology and is, well, where's God's role in this? And they're kind of different questions about justice, okay? The relationship is, you tell me more things that are truths about the story. Does that question make sense? Okay, good.
We should have the people here, and Bob would probably know their names. It leaves me. The family who lost all their children in that accident.
Oh, right. I was thinking the same thing. The Willises.
Willises, yeah. Where I'm sure everybody's heard about them. They took the day off and took all their children with them because there was going to be a lecture held in the school, and he was pastor and teacher in the school. He happened to have been a teacher in Batavia earlier. And they happened to hit a flap off of a semi, and it hit their gas tank, and the whole van exploded. The parents got out because they were in the front, but what was it, seven?
Seven, I think they had nine children, and seven of them died.
Seven of them died. And yet, they've been on television, and they have not, blamed God. I mean, their faith is as strong as it ever was. And they didn't really say that, God allowed them. He allowed them to go, to have these children, to go on this trip, but it wasn't God's fault. It wasn't. Whereas, most people say, well, certainly they are blaming God, yeah. Here they've been a good person, and everybody testifies to the fact that these people were very good people. Well, I always did for others. True story of Job, I think.
For sure. What truth out of that story paralleling Job do we write down here? A truth, we step back from the story and say, these are the things we know about it.
What's coming up from all of this is that righteousness is not earned. It can't be earned.
Righteousness isn't even involved.
It's grace.
Mm-hmm. It's God.
Is righteousness is irrelevant?
Don't think righteousness nor blessings are something we can earn.
Our brains and our hearts keep looking for cause and effect, a connection. We keep wanting to have some control over what happens to us. If I'm good enough, if I pray enough, right? I want to be in charge. I want to have some influence over my life. The slogan that control is just an illusion. We have centuries and centuries of people trying to make sense out of things by thinking that they can cause, and we can't.
Fundamentally, God is a mystery.
And he does not abandon us.
That way.
I mean, that's what, he's always with us, whatever happens.
And Job is not a lesser person because what's happened to him. I mean, wouldn't we all say that he's to be pitied, and there's a tremendous amount of tragedy, but it seems like to me that our rationalist side of us would say, what's the guy got to live for?
Also, the answer to that, a different way of saying that, maybe in the same way, is that God is not a lesser God because of what's happening to Job.
Yeah.
Does it say God is not lesser also? Does it do anything about God's justice? God is just. That's one of Job's beliefs that he clings to.
God did restore him.
But there's still seven dead kids. Or ten. You're right. And I'm just kind of asking the question as the devil's advocate to what... What does it say about justice? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going
to
build on the other idea, though, too, is that God is a personality change. And that personality change, it fits perhaps into that mystery idea. But even in this Marxist historian, his point of view was that one of the things he says here was at the end there will be justice. There'll be justice for all and justice for everyone, and you can't see it.
And death doesn't have the last word.
God's justice may not be what we envision it to be.
We'd like to define it. We'd like to make it happen.
And so
we
would
like
Joe.
Trying to define God.
That's right.
Which is why we admit it now.
A question that comes out of all these things, I think one of them that comes to my mind is that Job is much more interested in preserving his concept of God than his relationship with God. And his concept is, hey, as long as I keep, you know, doing the sacrifices in case my kids sin, I mean, like you said, in control, I'm okay. And then that, boom, he finds out he's not. Oh my gosh, my concept of God was wrong. Is it his relationship he doesn't want to keep going, or is it his admission that he doesn't want to admit that he was wrong about his concept of God? And there, readers and those of us who read it are like those of us, or like the characters in the story, too. We have concepts of God, and by God, I'm not going to change this. there's another. Good.
One of the struggles, I think, that I have when we use the Old Testament is that we're standing simultaneously looking at the Old Testament, but also looking at it from the other side of the cross.
Yeah.
And when you look at it from the other side of the cross, you look at the story, I think, differently than you do when you stand and look at it pre-Jesus. Because the other side of the cross is that God is with Job through his suffering. If we're lacking that, this would be much more to try and swallow and hang on to.
Although there is within the Old Testament a lot of tension between different concepts of God, and lots of challenges. The prophets are challenging the official court theology. There's a lot of that in there, which Job is just a piece of. You know, without having to throw Jesus in as, you know, our scapegoat. What I'm going to say is
answer.
The one that, and the answer, yes. Job's already trying to deal with that, the different concepts of God.
I think pre-cross, things you said make a lot of sense in the story of Job, trying to shake up the legalism, to shake up the being able to box in God and say, this is how it is, and this is how our faith should go, and if we do it this way, everything's okay.
Is there another story, too, going on, just to feed some concepts into this? What does Job have to go through to come to God? That's why I told that story at the beginning. This guy's hanging on to his secure branch, you know, and God says to him, let go, and I'll help you. Don't let go, you're going to struggle there. Did I make up that connection in my mind that I'm nuts? Which is a legitimate, yes, is a legitimate answer. How about that? What does Job have to go through to really does he have God in the beginning of the story? I mean, does he have a relationship with God? Does he understand that relationship? Does he understand what God is like?
He thinks he does.
He thinks he does, but does he? Hey, man, I just got to offer this sacrifice and I'm okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you've written it down about, Julie said righteousness is, he thinks it's earned. He thinks if I do all the right stuff, I've got it down.
It ties in with what we talked about yesterday, the self-awareness, and then needs to be the self...
Emptying was the word here, yeah.
In order to, as part of the process towards community, and that would be community with God as well.
And in the story, and it's, I think it's one of the affirming things about the story, it's more than a story of a man with patience. We've got it started over here too, is that in the story, who starts the conversation? If we read carefully, Job is not really cursing God. He's saying, the first thing he says in the very first poetry that we have right after where we stopped is, cursed be the day I was born. He doesn't say God. He says, damn, I wish I'd never been born. And he's cursing life because it's been so painful. So I'm suggesting that that's an interesting kind of thing, that he hasn't addressed God yet. And he keeps addressing his comforters, and he keeps addressing everybody to say, I want to know what I did. I'm innocent. And then he gets all these answers, baloney or not. He gets all these theories. But who initiates the connection between God and Job? God does. And he comes to him out of the whirlwind and speaks as if to say, in this whole story, if we step back and watch how the plot unfolds, he's got all these views of God, and I think I got it right, and we've just established that, Job, you got it all wrong. You have no relationship and no understanding of God, and you better get rid of that stuff. And it's going to take, in your case, you are so embedded in these beliefs, it's going to take a pretty violent experience to empty your phrase yesterday, to empty yourself of this, and to have some self-awareness about, can God be different than I thought?
Which is exactly what happened in Israel's life. Went into Babylonian captivity.
Sure.
You know, and then the exile for 7 years. What did we do wrong? We figured out what we did wrong. We're never going to do that again. They come back and they establish a whole theological pattern of we're never going to do that again. Before you know it, everybody's walking around and righteousness can be attained. Yeah. And Job comes and says, it can't.
That's great. And God, in the end of this book, the kids are still dead. The world situation for Job has not changed. I mean, he's going to get more kids, and that's going to change in that sense. But his kids are dead. His house was wrecked. His cattle and oxen and axes, they're all gone. Curse God and die. He didn't do that. He chose to live. And God comes to him, albeit out of a whirlwind, flashing his power. God still comes to him. And comes in almost a kind of, there is a kind of communion between Job and God. And what does Job, now we're out of stuff that we've read, outside of stuff that we read in class. Remember what Job says? I abhor myself and repent. And repent, we've heard it in a 16 zillion Bible studies this week, and last week, and all the time at Holy. Repent means to turn your life around. And all this stuff that Job... do you get the feeling he's going to go out and be offering sacrifices for his kids this time around? Because that's not where it is. He's come to a new kind of relationship. A faith changed, yeah.
And when you grow, it evolved into something more real.
It was incredibly violent. We can't deny it. It's uncomfortable. We hate it. It's a crazy story. We can't figure it out. But this is what it, in this story, this is what it took for Job.
And sort of leaving aside the question of who causes bad things to happen, it's certainly true that most of us would say God meets us in our point of greatest pain and need.
Say the very first thing you said,
putting aside who it is that... Or what it is that causes the disaster.
Put aside the cause. We absolutely have to do that in the story. Because the causes that we hear, we get explanations from the best minds that whoever wrote Job and the oral traditions that made it get written finally, whoever handed those on down, the best explanations we can think of are right there, and none of them work. So, Gloria says, put those aside. That maybe isn't the point of the story. And then we have to ask other big questions like that. Maybe the patience of Job, that isn't the point of the story. The faithfulness of Job, maybe that isn't the point of the story. Maybe it's all the things, this whole journey that you guys have spelled out and we've kind of scratched up here on the board, that brings Job to this kind of new faith or this new relationship is what the story is about. And that's a kind of affirmation. Not his process that's been violent and painful. But look, he let go of the branch, kind of thing. Good. More, yeah. You, back.
it just came to me, and maybe somebody else said this, and I just missed it, being over here in the corner. But it seems to me it's kind of a parallel with the creation story. Everything in Job's life was perfect, just like everything in the story of Eden was perfect. And it kind of knew how the relationship with God was. It was kind of pat, it was kind of easy. And then when they got kicked out of the garden, so to speak, the relationship with God became a lot more complex and kind of became real life. And Job's life wasn't real. He said he had never sinned and everything was perfect and life was perfect. And it seems to parallel that garden. And then afterwards, he's thrown into real life. the rest of us experience.
That is absolutely brilliant.
And that's my wife.
What else can you say?
That is a very interesting...
But it is. There are no robots in this system. And God doesn't want robots in Eden. I know that lots of people can interpret that creation story differently than this. But one legitimate interpretation is that there in Eden, where everything is innocent and perfect and there are robots, when God kicks them out, he puts up the cherub and the flaming sword to keep them from going back in. I don't want you in there. I don't want people that are robots and are going to... And I don't want people who just... You know, perfunctorily give sacrifices like the way Job does in his whole behavior. And I got God all figured out. This, and this cause and effect. No, this is the complex human condition. And Job, it's going to be tough. It's not unlike, I think, Peter's question, and I paraphrase it. Hey, Jesus, what's in it for me?
I find myself
nothing. You're going to get paid for.
I find myself wondering. Do I have to drop the 250 feet? What do I have to let go of? And how many bottoms do I have to hit? And can, I've heard the phrase, but I don't quite understand it, that sometimes the community can raise the bottom for you, so that when you hit bottom, you and you do repent and do surrender, that you didn't go as low as you might have if the community hadn't helped.
The community's down there with a fire net to kind of catch you.
It's like one of those phrases that I read in one of these where the kids had written, where the tree doesn't really hit the ground because the branches
don't. Yes. Have you guys read that? I think they're on the kiosk there too. Junior Miners Holden. Well, Job is a fun book. And you guys were fun to explore it with. Thank you. Yeah, let's go eat. Thank you.